You are a clever egg, Mr. Steel. Mm-hmm. Mr. Pebble Steel time.
Yeah, gotta watch what I'll do next. Yes.
We're gonna kickstart you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We'll kickstart your heart.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good song.
So what do they call it when they go past the thing? The threshold? When they over kickstart? What do they call those things? The whatever goals?
Stretch goals?
Yeah, the stretch goals. Stretch goals of my heart. That's what we gotta do. We gotta follow up to that other song with stretch goals of my heart.
I'm not familiar with that one.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the lesser known of the goals, I guess.
it was on the deluxe edition of the Motley Crue album.
let's steer away from the subject that I don't have any more knowledge in. So
Amanda stole my Motley Crue t-shirt this week. That's why I brought it up, and I'm upset about it.
That's a lot to unpack there. So number one, you have a Motley Crue t-shirt. Number two, you proudly own a Motley Crue t-shirt. Number three, you were upset someone took your Motley Crue t-shirt. Okay.
Yeah. The weirdest part about it is, I believe it was a gift from her, and I think she did one of those things. She claimed I wasn't wearing it often enough, so she stole it for whatever purposes, or, you know, wear around the house or something.
Yes. So by fiat, she seized your property.
You know, technically speaking, it's our property, I suppose. Mm-hmm. We both live under the same roof, so, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know that I have much legal recourse.
No, but you could complain more, I guess.
I don't know that I could complain more. Nah. Or that it would really do any good.
Yeah, well, nobody ever said complaining did anything, you know, super useful. So, speaking of complaining, anything else you would like to discuss before we get our show started?
I haven't slept much in the past couple of days.
Okay. I was thinking more along the lines of you were correct about your remembrance that it was a Skype call in Birdman, and then when I had insisted it was FaceTime, I was wrong.
Oh, who cares?
Yeah, well, I just want to get that out there, because I've received two tweets about it today, so it is a hot-button topic for listeners.
It's kind of hilarious that of all the things to give feedback on, that's the one you're getting feedback about.
Yes, yes. Well, at least it's a factual error, and it's not, you know, the other things that I was worried about of, like, oh, you don't understand art and you know, et cetera.
Maybe it's just that it's an easy enough thing to fit into a tweet, a correction, and the rest of them would be, well, and then paragraphs upon paragraphs.
So the program was actually Skype that was being used?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Craig Mazin in the latest script notes talked about how much he loved Birdman.
Yeah, I was sad about that.
I almost said Bird Notes.
Yeah, well, he was I think I wouldn't say loved. I would say more along the lines of gloating. he was quite upset about the that one website that reviews screenplays and scripts that are in production, and so he was very happy to gloat over them for the award win. But as I said on the previous podcast, I don't really care about what wins an award, because historically there have been a lot of things that we can agree now in this day and age aren't super relevant, like Crash or your favorite, The King's Speech, or et cetera, so on and so forth. That, you know, maybe an award show is not really a huge signifier of much, other than it can draw attention to a topic.
I do agree. But if you want to go see a Colin Firth movie these days, go see Kingsman, because there's a pug in the movie and it's awesome.
Okay.
Pugs.
Pugs.
I advocate for the pugs. I'm like the Lorax for pugs.
You speak for the pugs?
I speak for the pugs, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okie dokie. So if an alien probe came into the future and all of the pugs were gone, and the alien and the people from the future had to go back in time and try to get a set of pugs to take to the future with them, would you volunteer your pug to go to the future?
That would be the most aggravating thing in the history of the world, because we'd all just be trying to sleep like 45 minutes before our alarm goes off, and this probe would enter the atmosphere and just casually and get louder and louder and just quietly woof at the edge of our bed, asking where the hell the other pugs are, and just make us get out of bed and open the back door and take it outside and say, "What? What do you want?" And then it would just stand there staring at you for 30 minutes. Yes, what I'm saying is I would volunteer my pug because he can speak that language perfectly.
Okay.
I love my dog, but he's an asshole.
Okay. I'm sorry.
It's all right. He just gets up earlier than I do.
Mm-hmm. Well,
sometimes multiple times.
I'm glad this is about you. So, the future of humanity.
It's about all of the pug owning human race.
Mm-hmm.
Is there like a planet pug that this probe came from?
No, it doesn't matter, and it will never be revisited again in any other way. So you can just do whatever you want.
It just happened to be drifting through pug space and woofing at any starships that happened to be in the vicinity.
Yeah. Instead of a lead pipe, it would just be a big dog bone flying through space.
Yeah, what was that? It looked like a raw silicon ingot or something with like a little soccer ball that came out of it.
I don't know. It was alien, Dan. It was designed by an intelligence beyond our comprehension.
But was it actually supposed to be like a starship designed by whales?
I don't know. I've never seen a starship designed by whales. Have you?
I don't know. That's what I'm asking you. I may have.
I would find it impossible to discuss without a common frame of reference.
So you're saying I have to be a whale before we can talk about whale spaceships?
Yes.
That's some heady stuff there, man.
Yeah. See, I like that we have seamlessly feathered into a discussion about ridiculous things in this movie.
There's going to be 10% of the audience who knows what we're talking about and laughing, and the rest of them are going to refer us to some mental health doctors.
Oh, whatever. Everybody should have seen this. You know, Star Trek is a pop culture icon, and it's totally understandable that not everybody gets on board with that. But in the 80s, it was popular enough that, you know, there were tons of people that would turn out and see Star Trek movies, even if they didn't really consider themselves to be like Trekkies or hardcore fans or anything. They would still watch them. And so, you know, it's not as impossible as it is in this day and age to expect that people have seen it. You know, and people even turn out to go see the new J.J. Abrams movies. It was really, you know, a lot of what we think of as like, well, people don't like Star Trek. It, you know, it was really kind of a 90s, 2000s thing of subpar Star Trek, subpar Trek. And that's effect on the common movie-going public to just sort of shy away.
Hmm. I guess that makes sense. I saw the new J.J. Star Treks.
Yeah, exactly.
And as you're aware, I have zero affinity for these movies in general. Not out of any sort of malice. It's just like I didn't grow up with these movies or the TV show, so it's just not ingrained in my upbringing the way it is for others.
Yeah, and it's not a situation where I grew up in a family full of fans or anything. Like I was saying, you know, it was just sort of like something that people could watch at the time. And so my dad would watch it. He had seen some of the original series episodes, but he couldn't tell you anything about them other than, oh, yeah, it was like a Tribble thing in one. And same with my mom. So it was, you know, it's not like it was confined to just nerds. And in the, you know, one of my first exposures to Star Trek was watching Star Trek IV. On a VHS that my one of my uncles had recorded off of HBO, and so there was like all this tracking garbage and everything. Like it was really bad, but I would watch the crap out of it. That and my Star Wars tapes, you know, because what else were you going to do in the 80s? And the while not understanding how this pieced together with all of the other films or the old series or anything else, I still found this movie to be enjoyable as a child. Still a lot of fun. And I didn't understand sort of the deeper levels of anything, so that's okay. You know, it's whales and laughing and, you know, silly jokes about communist Russia that totally went over my head. But it's you know, it is what it is. And so when, you know, unfortunately last week, the news that Leonard Nimoy had passed away at 83 from complications with COPD, it was really sad because he is iconic in terms of Star Trek. I mean, it's not all he did and all he's known for, but it is predominantly mostly what he's known for. And many other podcasts have talked about podcasts and blogs and newspapers have pontificated about his life and his experience, and we won't go into that. But you know, it did make me want to go back and revisit some moments in Star Trek and sort of celebrate some things. And this is a movie he, you know, directed and starred in with an ensemble cast in the 80s, and it's a lot of fun. There's no big bad guy. There's nothing crazy happening. There is something crazy happening, let's be honest. But there's nothing like the fate of mankind and the universe and everything doesn't really hang in the balance. Like, it's kind of in the balance, but, you know, they're going to figure it out.
They're not destroying a city and or the entire race of a planet.
Yeah, it's
well,
not
kind of. But.
Well, I mean, it's one of those things where it's like eventually that might happen. But we all kind of know from watching the film that's not really the tone of this piece. It's not going to happen. Like, it's not like J.J. Abrams, we're going to, like, you know, blow up a planet or something. This really will be A-okay at the end. It's kind of a good, I think, a fun way to remember, like, his contribution to it, to Star Trek. Because he really defined not only the character of Spock, but, you know, two of the movies. Weighed in heavily creatively on many of the other things that followed after. So, and even appeared in both of the J.J. Abrams movies. So it's good stuff, I think, to go back and celebrate some of his previous works. And I'm sorry I had to force you to do it because this isn't really in your wheelhouse.
Hey, if you didn't, I don't know if I ever would have seen it, and I am glad that I have now seen it.
Yes, I liked when I mentioned it, and you were like, "That's the one with the whales, right?" And I was like, "Yep, yep, it is. Sure is."
You'll be happy to know that thanks to my sleep deprivation, I was a good like 15 minutes into the movie before I remembered that we did settle on the whales one. I'm like, "Oh, I get it—the sound and the thing. Sure."
Yeah. That's kind of one of the strange things if we want to get into the pacing of the film. But first, I'll just quickly summarize a couple things. The movie itself summarizes. There were previous movies, a previous television show. There were bad guys and stuff, and they have fought those bad guys on previous occasions. There have also been like lighthearted, funny things and time travel and stuff in the old series. The movies didn't really deal with the lighthearted stuff so much up until this one, which kind of dealt with predominantly all of the lighthearted stuff that you will find in all of the Star Trek movies, because they all go back to more serious tone after this. The thing here is you have to deal. Repercussions of previous films. The Enterprise was destroyed. They're on a Klingon bird of prey that they confiscated. They're on Vulcan. Spock was dead from some complications and put back together again, but not quite fully who he was. And they've got to go back to Earth for trial for the events that have happened in previous films. For confiscating the Enterprise, getting it blown up, and stealing this Klingon bird of prey. And that sets us up at the beginning of the film, and in here they layer in a couple of those things in sort of a, you know, TV episode, like previously seen on kind of a way, where they, you know, have a couple clips from Star Trek 3 and Star Trek 2 of the Genesis device, and they have the Enterprise blowing up on that big screen in the council chambers. That's fine because we don't need to know every detail of everything, but it does let us know that this is part of a continuing mission, I guess you could say. And we get into, after the, like you're saying, the first 15 minutes, we get into the actual point of this film, which is time traveling, to go rescue two humpback whales in the 1980s, specifically in the time frame that the movie was filmed. So this was present day when the film was recorded. It wasn't. It's not like one of those things where we were shooting it now and they were traveling back to the 80s. So it is also kind of interesting in that way, because then there's also this other layer of period piece layered on top of this, where the future is old looking and the past is also very old looking, and the way people behave is very different from what we might expect from a modern audience.
I think it was kind of funny that their outfits, their future outfits, appear to have come from the 70s or something. I don't quite understand what's going on there.
Oh, their casual outfits are so bad. And that's one of these funny things where Star Trek II, they're all in uniform, and it's a different uniform from the first movie, because the first uniform from the first movie was pajamas. The second uniform was that red thing that you saw later. In the third movie, when they steal the Enterprise, they have to wear their casual clothes. And so they wore these casual clothes all through the third movie, and then they're wearing them all through the fourth movie. I don't know why. They could have changed clothes at some point. like multiple days have passed, weeks have passed, time has moved on, and they have worn the same outfit every day.
Well, they're stranded on a planet, and I think it does kind of add to that thing you were talking about, where it just kind of picks up, and it doesn't necessarily assume you know everything that's happened, but it just does kind of pick up as if it were an episode of the show, but it's clearly a movie, and it's just like, oh, we're in the same world, we're just picking up right where we left off, we're not like starting from scratch necessarily, and just moving on from here, so no big deal.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know how hard was it for you to get into it, from the initial outset of the horrible music and titles over Starfield.
The opening titles are very long, very, very long. Mm-hmm. That was unpleasant. But then, you know, I don't know if all Star Trek movies are like this, or just at least the first J.J. Abrams one, at least to my recollection. I don't remember the beginning of Into Darkness, but it starts out in space with some strange phenomenon, and then some ship that is not the Enterprise or our main cast of characters, and something crazy is happening, and then we cut to see what the rest of our folks are doing. But that whole bit, and then the bit about the who are the folks ranting about the things that happened in the previous movie and giving us sort of our exposition in that courtroom setting, that bit was like, it didn't necessarily hold my attention, but I didn't fall asleep during it, so that's good. But yeah, I really didn't pick up interest until they were on their way back to Earth, which, I guess, like, I didn't necessarily need to see the decision-making process, or maybe Kirk just made the decision really quickly that, like, you know what, we're just going to go back to Earth and fess up and plead guilty to our charges, and then we'll deal with it as we're supposed to do. But then, like, once they're on the ship, they're so matter-of-fact about, like, well, we're going to go back in time now. It's just, at that point, I was like, what? And that particular sentiment held my interest for the rest of the movie.
Well, you know, they had traveled to the past several times in the original series, and they had done this maneuver where they slingshot around the sun. Now the audience isn't really expected to know
terrible
that.
Terrible looking sun. Sun looks so bad.
It was the style at the time. But. You know, the plot device was something that was pre-existing, and so McCoy references this, and he also references the sort of trepidation about this, because it could be dangerous and they've done it before, but you know, it might not work out, and that's supposed to bring you up to speed on maybe this isn't something that everybody does every day, and the way that the time travel unfolds, the pressure on the ship, the drained power, you know, nearly being stranded back in the past and stuff like that. It, you know, at least it makes it seem like time travel isn't like the easiest thing in the world, that they do it every day or something. But there are many, 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 many time travel stories in Star Trek.
Yeah, it's not necessarily that it appeared that it was the easiest thing or the most common thing, but, you know, in typical, old sci-fi fashion. Like, the camera is just, like, slightly shaking, and, like, some picture frames are falling off shelves, and it's meant to be all dramatic, like, oh, God. And then I guess they, like, pass out or black out from the speed, but they just sort of look like they fell asleep in their chairs watching TV or something, and then they all slowly wake up together.
Oh, no, you glossed over an important fact. The dream sequence.
Oh, God. The CG heads morphing between each other?
Yes. Linearly what interpolating positions.
What in the hell?
I love it. I mean, I love it in the way that it is totally cheesy. And it is not something that, much like the Genesis effect, it was a marvel that it was done at the time, but a more sophisticated eye of anyone over the age of three, in a modern setting, who has seen other things on TV or in films, would very easily not be impressed by this dream sequence. It is pretty ridiculous.
I mean, there was a lot of pretty good looking stuff in it, especially for 1986. But that bit was just—I don't know what that was there to do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, remember, you know, this is around the time of like Ghostbusters and stuff. Like it. You know, it was the height of effects. It just now it just doesn't really, like, it's not amazing anymore. Yeah.
I thought their ship looked good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't understand the whole thing with the body that falls into the water and the liquid nitrogen spray stuff, like that like montage of photographic elements that comes after that, and then fading to the cattails or the, what are they called? The
cattails. I don't remember.
I don't remember either. The reed things. Fading to those, and then fading back into the bridge, and it's just like, well, I don't know why you needed to do all of that. But that was sort of, you know, it was kind of 80s-y.
Maybe when they were in their time warp, somebody slipped them some LDS.
Yes, a little too much LDS back at Berkeley. But they wind up in Earth of the past. And Spock judges by the pollution content of the atmosphere that they have arrived to the latter half of the 20th century.
what a great metric for measuring the year that you're in.
I know, I loved it. And this is also highlights something that you probably don't know, and that is the future part of the movie, being the beginning and the end, is written by Harve Bennett, who was the producer that was brought on in Star Trek II, and he wrote and produced Star Trek 3, and he wrote these parts of Star Trek 4, and Nicholas Meyer wrote all of the stuff that's in the past, all of the 80s stuff. So from that first line that Spock delivers there, on until they travel back to the future, it's all Spock line. It's all Nicholas Meyer writing for that stuff. And he does a good job. He's a fan favorite. He wrote Star Trek 2 and directed it, and he wrote with a partner for Star Trek 6 and directed Star Trek 6. So he gets around and contributes to things. It's part of the reason why the dialogue is so lively, I think, as he's a more contemporary sensibility.
You're going to have to elaborate on lively. I mean, there was a lot of switch to reserve power set to something that, like, sounded all impressive if it meant anything, but I don't know. There were a lot of things happening. I'm just like, uh-huh. Apparently this is how you run a spaceship. Sorry, starship, whatever.
Oh, well, that's the stuff that happens in the future, really. Like, when they get to the past, they don't really talk about that stuff. They're just like, oh, well, set us down in Golden Gate Park, you know, turn on the cloaking device, right. And then...
The decision to land in Golden Gate Park. Just... Mm-hmm. And the way Golden Gate Park is depicted in this movie is fantastic. Like the trash truck just driving through, the scientist woman who just drives her truck around in the grass to drop them off. It's like, what are you doing? This is a public park. Get your cars out of here.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Maybe it was different in the 80s. But also, it wasn't technically Golden Gate Park. They couldn't film there because of mud or something. So they filmed that in Los Angeles. But whatever. It was grass and some trees. But I do love that landing scene of the two garbage truck guys being freaked out by the ship landing. Also, you know, $60 for a toaster oven. You know, he's quite irate about that. But I know that I've heard criticism from John Syracuse that you know, $60 might not be enough to spend on a toaster oven. That's all I'm
Well,
gonna say.
In 1986, adjusted for inflation, that better be a pretty good toaster oven. And back then, I think that was the era when they were making toaster ovens that did not have wobbly little plastic knobs and had the doors that didn't auto close on his fingers.
Yeah, very true. So maybe the garbage truck guy was taking that all into account.
I did like the garbage truck guys with the did you see that? No, and neither did you. And then the why you still with her? All you do is argue or something. It says, I like the way she argues. Like it seems like somebody pulled them out of a New York script rather than San Francisco, but they worked. They were funny.
Yeah, well, that the movie has a lot of that. And like once they land and they open the door and walk out, we cut to them in the middle of bustling wherever they are in San Francisco. I'm not as familiar with the geography. I think it's Market Street. And they you know, are trying to navigate the first street they've ever crossed in the middle of the city for some reason, where they're surprised by cars. And we get the lovely lines like "double dumbass on you" and all of the colorful metaphors that start to play out for the rest of the film.
It's too bad they didn't travel back to 2015, where the Uber driver would have to be really polite to them.
Yeah, well, maybe they can do that in the new reboot when they travel back in time and save something else other than whales, because they're passe these days.
It's a parallel universe, so it would be the same sort of plot but with different details. Maybe they'll save the pugs or like a kiwi or something.
Yes, dramatic kiwi shortage. the scene is funny, the music so interesting for jazz fusion, and the decision that they need to, you know, have money to spend on things results in them wandering off to a pawn shop, or an antique store, I guess, and selling the glasses that were given to Kirk as a gift in the future, the antique glasses, which, you know, Kirk highlights will be a gift again in the future. So technically, he might have gifted himself the glasses that he gets in the future.
Yeah, they do kind of thumb their nose at a couple of time paradoxes. That being one of them, and then the other one being the see through aluminum or whatever it's called.
Transparent aluminum and
transparent aluminum. That's the thing.
Yeah, aluminium for our British listeners. And the that's so silly. And then the other big paradox comes later with a certain whale biologist. The scene is interesting in that they don't really know how much money they're getting out of this deal.
I did like that. $100. Is that a lot? And the guy just kind of shrugs. Like, even he's like, yeah, not really.
And they take other money and distribute it, and they split up into teams. And we start to get some full-on Shatner moments with his capacity to be himself.
There's so much dismissive Shatner charisma in this movie.
Yeah. And you know, it's one of those things where it's kind of funny because Leonard Nimoy, who is playing Spock, in a very reserved fashion, is also technically the director of the film. So he's directing Kirk in these scenes where he is also, you know, playing second fiddle, basically, of being sort of the butt of the joke in some of these. It's kind of interesting. Like when they, you know, go to look at the map and he's like, well, using the coordinates that we have, and then he's like, oh, well, simple logic. We have, you know, it's George and Gracie. You know, then what does it mean, exact change? But they sort that all out. They get on the bus and he does the Vulcan nerve pinch to
some punk rocker.
Yeah.
Oh, it was so delightfully 80s, that bit too.
Yeah,
like it's the worst like Disneyfied punk rock stereotype I've ever seen.
Yeah, but it kind of works in a very broadly comedic sense. Knock him out, and somehow him falling forwards turns off the power on his boom. I don't know, but anyway, moving past that, the scene is kind of funny, and they talk a little about, you know, colorful metaphors and literature of the time. And they arrive at the aquarium to go visit the whales, which isn't really the real aquarium. It's the Monterey Aquarium, not the Cetacean Institute. And they get their tour from a very sophisticated lady who probably shouldn't be giving tours, because if she was actually the like senior assistant whale biologist, whatever it is, then like why is she giving like docent tours? Like, shouldn't that be like
she's
an old volunteer woman doing
man.
That?
She just loves the whales so much.
Yes, yes.
Although, maybe this was part of the messaging of the story that Nimoy wanted to put in there, or maybe this is just a sign of the times, but there's that incredibly graphic historical footage of actually killing whales.
Yeah, I think, well, this is very much a product of the 80s, and in the 80s, they were very there was a concern in the mid to late 80s and early 90s to mid 90s about the environment. You might be familiar with it from such shows as Captain Planet and the Planeteers, and other things of that ilk, where, you know, pollution, rainforest destruction, extinction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They were all pretty big topics for artsy things to cover, because they were big issues. We talk about that stuff less these days, so it kind of seems funny whenever you go back to this sort of like very broad discussion of the environment and like saving whales,
like the PCU, the hippie on the mall waving the sign that says save the whales, and that's pretty much about it.
Yeah. So they you know swim with the kitties, we get a very interestingly composited scene of that whale underwater, and Leonard Nimoy diving in that water to mind meld with the whale, which people might not know this at the time, but the Humane Society or something, some animal group went after the people making the film because they thought they had abused the whales in making the film, but they didn't actually use any real whales except for some stock footage. So these are all completely fake whales. And
where was the abuse? In the making them sit still so he could touch them?
Yeah, well, apparently. Well, I mean, you're not supposed to like do that for a lot of reasons, mostly because they might like flip a tail and kill you by accident, but they thought they had actually done some of these things in this film and like positioned them to film certain scenes in this film. Of course, that is not actually the case, and they were all puppets for the most part. So we also kind of get the feeling that we're going to be seeing more of our intrepid whale biologist in the future, because they didn't spend all this time setting her up for nothing, even though she does kick them out of the Cetacean Institute. We cut back to what the other teams are doing, like Uhura and Chekhov asking for directions to Alameda, where they keep the nuclear vessels. Which
because of course as soon as they landed there was a problem with the power source for the ship, so they have to solve that problem before they can go back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I love how quickly Spock diagnoses the problem and finds the solution, and just, you know, sort of matter of fact, they're like, oh well, we've got to find some nuclear fission to get that to put the I can't even remember the particles back into the crystal.
The highly energized photons can cause crystalli restructure, I think was the long, I don't know, I'm trying to remember from having seen it 20 or 30 times, but I don't remember the exact line.
It's the sci-fi equivalent of growing a geode in a shoebox underneath your bed.
Yes well, I mean, this is, you know, something everyone should be familiar with in Star Trek, is that whenever they get to something that doesn't really matter and they just need to move the story along, you just spackle it over with some technobabble. And so this is a generous smattering of technobabble for why they need to go find the ship. And so we have someone who is pretending to be someone with a thick Russian accent asking for directions to nuclear weapons.
Nuclear vessels.
Yes.
I love it. The Futurama part where they see the Star Trek cast. Did you ever see that episode?
Yes. Where they are, their heads are put back on to the bodies by that alien who wants to play with them on the planet. Yeah.
And I just love Fry. Say nuclear vessels. No. Do it.
Nuclear vessels. No, but the situation is kind of funny in that, of course, communism and the 80s. So hilarious. And the funny thing is the line at the end there with the lady who says, you know, when they ask like how to get to Alameda, she says, I don't know. I think it's across the bay in Alameda. They like
that
line.
That's what I just said.
Yeah. Yeah. But they liked that line and they wanted to keep it in the film. But she was just an extra. So then they had to actually put her into the like billing or something for the crew in order to use the line that she had. So it was not in the script, but it was kind of funny. And so I greatly recognize that Leonard Nimoy was working on his feet when he discovered that would be a good thing to include.
It was funny.
Yeah. And we also get Montgomery Scott and DeForest Kelly playing Dr. Bones McCoy going to the Plexicorp offices in order to try to get the materials that they'll need. And I loved the scene. I loved it when I was a kid because we had a Mac Plus. And even though this Mac Plus in the movie does not actually work like how a Mac Plus works and obviously is a movie computer, it was still hilarious to me when he picks up that mouse and he says, "Hello, computer." Because he doesn't...
I've even seen this clip before. This has been passed around on the internet a few times.
Yeah, like I was saying, this movie is full of things that are cultural, you know, touchstones that people have referenced. If you haven't seen this movie up until now, you've at least seen references of things that are in this movie because so many people have an admiration for this film in many ways. And this scene is hilarious because it's, you know, someone from the future trying to interact with the old technology. And then he quickly gets the hang of things and then just starts typing nonsense and screens flash. And then all of a sudden we have a 3D representation of the molecular structure of a transparent aluminum.
I like that because he's from the future, he can type incredibly fast and do all of these things just incredibly quickly. But really, he would probably not really remember how to actually type things with his hands.
No, well, I mean, that's why if you look at what James Doohan, the actor, is doing, it's just sort of like...
Yeah, it's pretty terrible.
Yeah, it's just like slapping fingers on the keyboard.
It reminds me of Farva from Super Troopers when he's looking up license plates.
Yeah, my favorite thing about the scene, though, after the Hello Computer, is when the guy's contemplating whether or not it's worth something to him, and the door opens, and this woman walks in, and the guy turns and he shouts at her, "Not now, Madeline." she just freezes and turns around and leaves. We don't need to know anything about Madeline. But it just worked out to be a nice comedic beat, and it lets you know how intensely that he would like to have this thing. And at like the aside with Scott and Bones, where they're just like, you do realize by giving him this, we're changing the future. And he says, "Oh, how do we know he didn't invent the thing?" Which is very Bill and Ted.
Which is his way of saying, screw it.
Yeah. Just glossing over that fact. I mean, the butterfly effect wasn't out at the time, so maybe they didn't see it, and then because of the events of this, it changed the future where they wouldn't have seen the butterfly effect? I don't know.
When they go back to the future, it would have been great if every metal material was just see-through, just because.
Yeah. You could have invisible planes. But the thing is, that enables them to get the stuff they need for their whale enclosure. And the we go back to Kirk and Spock walking their way back to San Francisco. Unfortunately, they were walking because they were doing so at such a slow rate that Dr. Gillian Taylor was able to catch up with them. For some psychotic reason, she decides that she wants to get to know them better, which seems implausible. But she's a very curious individual, and sort of like pokes and prods, and you know, I got a tire iron where I can get to it, so don't try anything.
Well, Kirk is charismatic, and Spock is intriguing, and we did gloss over, but I love how they were like, well, no one on Earth has ever seen an alien, and he just tears a strip off of his little robe outfit and ties it across his eyebrows like a karate headband.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's San Francisco, you know. I mean, how normal is normal in San Francisco? You can walk around in a bathrobe in San Francisco, no problem. People walk around like naked or mostly naked, which is disgusting. And then, you know, everybody else in their weird future uniforms. I bet you could walk in San Francisco and find someone wearing exactly what Kirk is wearing, that pink blouse with the ribbing across it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, but it's better. You're not familiar with this, but in a classic episode of Star Trek, there is The City on the Edge of Forever, which is a very famous episode in which they come across an alien portal which allows them to travel back in time. And something happens to Bones, and he goes back in time, and he saves this woman from being killed. But because he saved this woman from being killed, he altered the events that caused everything to unfold the way it did. And there's no space exploration, and so above the surface of the planet, the Enterprise is no longer there. The Federation's gone, everything. So Kirk and Spock have to travel back in time through the alien portal and try to keep him from saving this woman. Like, she needs to die in order for the events to unfold. And they travel back in time, and so Spock has to pretend to be a human, or to blend in with everything. And the excuse that they used for his ears, do you want to know?
Yes. I can't think of anything.
It was a rice picker incident. I'm not joking.
What?
That is literally what he says to excuse the pointy ears. A rice picker incident. I have no idea. I don't know how you could even say that with a straight face when you're writing that in the 60s, but they did.
You could say that would make me stop you quicker and say, I'm sorry, you're going to have to explain that a little further.
Yeah, well, at least they knew not to do that in the 80s, and they didn't. And they just tied a piece of the robe around his head. Because revisiting that would have been bad. Let's not ever say that again. But that is an example of the long and troubled history of Star Trek. that was used once as an excuse for something.
I'm shocked nobody called Kirk on his pointy sideburns.
Oh, God, everybody has pointy sideburns. But the you should be more shocked about it, the quality of his hairpiece.
It held up really well in the water too. I was surprised.
I know. It's so funny. Especially when you see the like giant swath of it sort of like part to the side. Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so funny. That's what happens when you want to do all of your action scenes. Picking it back where we left off, where she picks him up. And she sort of interrogates them on questions, and they're firing back, and they're like, oh, well, how did he know that she was pregnant? And he's like, she told me. And the LDS line, and the whole thing of the whales are going to eventually be moved because they're pregnant. Like, all of this stuff is unfolding here. And they have a couple of funny exchanges with her. You're like, you're not exactly catching us at our best. That much is certain. And she offers, you know, like, you know, let's all go to dinner. And we get the best exchange in this film of, I like Italian and so do you. Which is just like the best, just the best. Yes, no, yes, no. Just, great. I love it. And you even laughed, according to your text message to me, that that it was the second time you laughed in the whole film.
I did. It was a very sort of like improv-y moment. Like, do we like Italian? Do we know what Italian food is? Sure. Yes. No. No. Yes. No. Because that was when Kirk had tried to convince Spock that, like, maybe it's okay to stretch the truth a little bit just to get what you want. And Spock's clearly like, well, in this situation, I don't know what the right answer is, so I'm kind of trying to play off of him. But yeah, whatever. No. I meant yes. Sorry. No. Sure? Whatever.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to go with the flow, guys. I just don't know what to say.
Yeah. And so they drop off Spock in the park, and it is his way that he'll wander around. And he's very quickly beamed up to the ship, like within a couple feet's distance of the truck. They could have waited a minute.
If he would have started doing Tai Chi in the park, he would have blended in so well. Nobody would have thought he was crazy at all. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, San Francisco crazy, not like crazy crazy.
Yeah, which is like normal in San Francisco. And the so they go to their dinner at this restaurant, which seems so absurd. The pizza order and the Michelob. I've never in my life ordered a Michelob, just to be perfectly honest. And
I know a surprising amount of people who drink that Michelob Ultra. I don't understand it. What was on their pizza? It was something kind of ridiculous too, wasn't it? It was mushrooms and a bunch of other crap.
Oh yeah, it was like mushrooms, extra onions, olives. It was a mess.
See, this is where I wish I knew a little bit more about the Star Trek universe. Like, do they not have pizza and or beer where in the future?
Well, they have synthahol in the future, which is a synthetic alcohol which keeps you from getting drunk.
What's the point of that?
Because it can provide sort of the sensation of being drunk, but then you don't have any hangover or anything.
Well, that's... I took a little bit of that cue from when he drank his beer and kind of made like a, well, what is this kind of face?
Yeah. Well, I mean, they still had booze and stuff in the era that he's from. And there's another movie where it's kind of a plot point that they have too much Romulan ale to drink. But let's not get into what is and is not...
Does he drink too much ale and then it fades to black and he wakes up in some green girl's bed and goes, oh, God.
No. A little more complicated. Dead chancellor of the Klingon. Anyway. So the situation is interesting in that we get this sort of 80s rom-com like date scene at a restaurant. Which is a little unusual for your Star Trek movies, in that none of them would ordinarily have this. This is sort of a genre-bending moment where, because of the device of traveling back in time, you can have a scene like this. We're momentarily transported to other comedies of the era, where they have sort of, you know, the witty dialogue back and forth of, you know, like quippy little things that they say to each other. And I don't mean witty, like it's actually that witty, but quippy, I guess. You know, would like the explanation, you know, she would like the explanation, you know, more than all of the tea in China and et cetera, et cetera. And his pocket pager, which is an important reference.
And then of course, I told you not to call me here. Just like the most standard of silly lines.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's standard now, but I mean, 1986, nobody called anybody at a table.
But why didn't she just assume it was like a radio or something? Radio was a thing they had back then, just because it was small, maybe.
I mean, have you ever seen a ham radio? They're not tiny. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter. It's just kind of funny. And his whole speech about how he's actually from the future, and the fake laugh and the fake laugh back, and the whole thing about, you know, I'm from Iowa, I only work in outer space, the whole thing about getting the whales and how soon they'll be released, and she's not only pregnant, she's very pregnant. They finally end in, you know, the whales are getting shipped out tonight, and then they have to leave, and we get the line that you could only have in the 80s of who gets the bad news, which means who gets the check. And it is great. I love that that's there instead of who gets the check, because it's just like what a what a somewhat cheesy thing to say for a waiter.
It is funny that Kirk is just like all the more ready to retort when she says, I suppose they don't use money in the future. It's like, they don't, seriously. Like, he's actually like trying to explain. He's dumbfounded that he's found himself back in an age where money is an actual thing.
Yeah, well, I guess he ran out of his glasses money. And so they leave the pizza place, and
it should be mentioned, I think the most offensive part of that scene is the fact that she took him to a pizza place in San Francisco. Of all of the restaurants to go to in San Francisco, pizza, really?
Yeah, they're not known for the pizza. Neither is LA, really. San Francisco, definitely not. I mean, they should have gone, had a mission burrito, and that would have been a weird scene.
Or go get some seafood or something. Eat some crab legs. Yeah. Kirk should go eat some other extinct animal.
Yeah. What's the what's it called? The seafood thing. The chip.
Chipino.
Chipino. They could have had Chipino down by the wharf.
Could have had a V8 or a Chipino.
Yeah, Frisco. Do the Frisco stuff.
You're not supposed to call it Frisco. That means you're a tourist.
Well, I am a tourist. I don't want to live in San Francisco. Haven't you seen the kind of people that go there?
I'm one of them. I like San Francisco.
Okay, I was talking about people in pink blouses and bathrobes, but yeah, but the thing,
you know what they say: if you're going to San Francisco, be sure to wear your pink blouse and a bathrobe.
Yes, and walk past a giant building painted with a Yellow Pages ad.
Is that product placement or just bad writing?
I don't know. Maybe both. It was kind of funny. But going back to the Uhura and Chekhov beam into the naval vessel, and they go to the reactor and they set up their silly little device thing to do its thing. Kirk gets dropped off at the park, and he's all like, "Oh well, don't take too long, because, you know, gotta act fast, and this is where I'll be." And he walks out with the pizza. And I just have to ask, every time I watch this, why did she pay for everything and give him the pizza?
Because she's a nice person? What do you mean?
She's a sucker for hard luck cases, but why did she pay for everything and give him the pizza?
Oh. I think, at least the way I read it, is that they both ordered a slice of pizza and he was just taking a slice.
No, I thought they ordered the whole, because when the waiter comes out, he has a whole pan, like a deep dish style pan thing.
Well, that would be stupid, though, because when he's ordering, Kirk says two of those. So I thought maybe she ordered a slice or two of her weird pizza and he just wanted the same. But I guess that would be, I don't know.
No, I think you don't really get
a single slice of pizza in a restaurant.
I think he was just ordering another beer.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess I read it as like a slice of pizza to go, but yeah, you're probably right. That's weird. Maybe he gave her a slice.
We should probably go into something really deep and important here. Because this is a subject we haven't talked about on the show. And we really need to get this out there. I think the listeners want to know. What toppings do you put on your pizza?
This is going to be controversial. You know, I actually I had pizza just tonight. I won't tell you what brand because that will diverge us from the topic. Typically, there are varying degrees. Okay, I'll state that it can be a combination of any or none of these ingredients. But typically, pepperoni. I enjoy some black olives from time to time. If I'm feeling frisky, maybe some jalapenos or banana peppers. And I think that's probably about it on a regular basis. Now, if we're talking about fancy pizza, you can do like some other type of cured Italian meat, maybe some ricotta on there. It varies. Some artichoke hearts, maybe, if you're feeling kind of funny.
So I could only notice that when you said banana peppers, it made me think of the places that would have banana peppers. That would be a chain. And so I have to ask now.
No, not just chains that have banana peppers.
Did you have Papa John's?
No. And you know I haven't had Papa John's because Papa John's doesn't deliver to my house.
So it was Pizza Hut.
No comment. But tonight, actually, I had cheese pizza. That's why I mean when it can be any combination or none of these toppings.
A whole cheese pizza all to yourself?
Half a cheese pizza. The other half had pepperoni and mushrooms on it. And I'm not a fan of mushrooms on my pizza.
Mm, interesting. Okay. Yeah, so this is good info, listeners. When you buy Dan a pizza and send it to his house, make sure that it is either cheese or full of all of those things that he just said. And no,
let's put it this way. If you want to buy me a good pizza, go on down to Bell Italia on Chandler Boulevard near the I-10. They're a real pizzeria, and that's where we do the various Italian meats and or ricotta and the artichokes. And you know, they've got real ingredients that don't come out of a can, and it's quite good.
And what about a Pizzeria Bianca? What do you order there?
Oh, God. It's been so long since I've been to Pizzeria Bianca. But
because it's so far?
Yeah, it's very far away. It's very far away. I don't go downtown very often.
Mm-hmm. What is that, 30 mm-hmm. minutes?
Well, everything's 40 minutes, basically.
Oh, it's 40 minutes? Okay.
Yeah. It's closer to free-range llama territory than it is to my house.
Yeah, llama on a pizza, that would be interesting.
That would be doable, but probably a little gamey. But we haven't heard your pizza preferences.
Okay, well, first, what if we traveled back in time and you had to save llamas from Arizona? And they had to be specifically those llamas in that chase.
I would have to bring a lasso.
And then go to the future. What if the people who lassoed them were from the future?
Then he did a very convincing job of dressing like he's from the now. I think he had a cowboy hat on, too. Do they have cowboy hats in the future?
Only on holodecks.
Hmm. If you lasso a llama in a holodeck, did it actually happen?
Wow. Okay. So my pizza toppings. Tonight I also had pizza. A frozen pizza. And it was a barbecue chicken frozen pizza, which isn't really pizza at that point. It's more of a flatbread, I guess you could say.
Wait. Frozen barbecue chicken pizza? So this is a California Pizza Kitchen.
It probably was.
I've had that.
And so you had your Pizza Hut one, and I had my California Pizza Kitchen one. And so together, we have united to make this a podcast about people with terrible taste in pizza, especially with Dr. Jillian Taylor. You go, girl.
I have to put my foot down, though. We would not be eating this garbage if we were in San Francisco. I must state that.
Okay, well, I don't know. I mean, you're in an actual metropolitan area, and so am I. So
that is debatable.
You ordered from a chain restaurant, and I picked up a frozen pizza. So, I mean, how lazy are we?
Well, it's because it's literally the only place other than Domino's that delivers to my house. And I had a limited time frame because I had to watch a movie.
Uh-huh.
Speaking of that movie,
yeah.
to put us back on track, maybe.
Uh-huh. So, the reactor... is interfering with the transporter and they're almost out of power. Because it takes a lot of power to completely disassemble a human being and turn them into electrons and absorb it through a beam and reconstruct a human being out of it into normal atoms. So, you know, yeah. He has to beam back one at a time and he gets Uhura. And then before he can get Chekhov, he gets caught by the... wonderful Navy police officers who are patrolling the ship, and they take him up to be interrogated by 1980s/1950s police interrogation guy. And they have the, you know, who's on first kind of conversation about you know names and things of that sort. It's just mildly comedic. And then the whole thing where he threatens to shoot them with the phaser, and then it malfunctions because of the radiation from the reactor. And we get some terrible...
How great is it that he just runs out the door, too? Like, he's being interrogated by, like, all of these cops, and he just turns and runs out the door.
It's a it's a bold move when you're not used to running away on a Navy vessel to try to think that that would work out well. But you know, fight or flight, they say, and fight didn't work. So we get some terrible chase music from Leonard Rosenman here. But some competently executed action chase choreography of people running and ducking and hiding and falling flat on the floor, which is apparently the exact procedure that they're supposed to do if someone is, you know, if an intruder is running around on deck, just so they don't get shot by friendly fire or anything. And he makes his way towards the gangplank, sees the people coming up, and then goes over by some rope, and then, whoa, falls on the ground. And it, there is an unfortunate spotlight that highlights the mistake he made, placed right there. Poor guy. And we get the whole thing of nobody being concerned at all that they can't find him for, like, what, 12 hours or something? They're the next morning, they're assembling their tank, and Dr. Jillian Taylor has gone to see off the whales that she thought would be there to be taken out in what was sure to be a media extravaganza circus. But she shows up, parks her truck right at the front door, which is a heck of a parking spot, really, and then walks in to find the matte painting of a completely empty tank. She's so upset about this. She slaps her really smarmy, terrible boss. I feel bad for this guy. It's like, come on. He just seems like so unreasonably bad at being a human being. But she smacks him.
I didn't want you to get upset, so I shipped them out in the night when you weren't around. Like,
yeah, we thought it would be easier on you.
You thought that would be a good idea? Sure, okay.
Yeah, she's such a calm, level-headed person and hasn't shouted at you once in this movie. And so she goes outside and smashes her wrists and her hands and breaks every bone in her body on the hood of her car, and then hops in and has the dramatic acting moment of realizing that she needs to drive to go see Kirk. She takes her pickup over to Golden Gate Park, waves her hands around, pantomimes running into the side of an invisible spaceship.
She's working on her mime routine, doing the invisible wall.
Yes. I felt bad for her. I mean, it's like, just give her like some plexiglass to push against or something. I mean, something. Because it looks like exactly what it is. But they beam her inside the ship, which is funny because he was so opposed to showing it to her, like I said, 12 hours ago. But now he's like, hello, Alice, welcome to Wonderland. And, you know, she sees the tank being set up in the spaceship, and she sees Spock with the pointy ears. Nobody's concerned at this point. It's just like, oh, well, the girlfriend's moved in. And the thing's kind of funny in that he's explaining their plan to take the whales to the future and the tanks. But they can't leave because they're a ship with a missing man. And they go talk to Uhura, who has figured out the hospital that Chekhov is in from the police broadcasts and stuff that she's been monitoring. And so they need to go look like doctors, and Jillian is responsible for making that happen. And Bones has the very important role of saying, you know, we can't just leave him in the hands of, you know, 20th century medicine. And we go to the hospital. And one of my favorite scenes in the film is, of course, when McCoy is wandering around by himself and runs into that old lady. And he asks what's wrong. And she says, kidney dialysis. And he freaks out. He says, dialysis. And he gives her, like, some pills.
Just his anger and indignation of just walking around going, like, what is this, the Dark Ages? Like, what are you people doing? For the love of God, stop cutting people open.
I love it. Like, we're dealing with medievalism here, and what is the damn Spanish Inquisition? He says when they're in the elevator. He is a very passionate soul, and I gotta give it to DeForest Kelly for the enthusiasm that he puts into pulling off his righteous indignation. And their clever plan of saying that she has cramps in order to get into an already full operation room, passed to police officers with 1980s hair, and they push the doctors off into the little area, and then they do the only phaser shot in the entire movie where they melt the lock on the door. And then they take...
It was a very accurate shot.
Yeah, I mean, well, not as accurate as when he shot a bloodworm that was next to Chekhov's head in Star Trek II, but that's a different story. But the whole thing here with the operating table, there's he chucks the big metal drill on the floor, and he takes out the little medical device he's going to use. And it's kind of funny, because if you recognize what it is part of the engine of a Klingon D7 battlecruiser model kit that was repurposed into being a little medical appliance, because one of the things that Star Trek excels at is taking things that should be something else and then just slightly modifying them to be something else. And so he puts that on his forehead, and then he fixes the artery. Chekhov regains consciousness, and they have the jazzy little hospital escape with the terrible music that I hate. And it is one of these things where you got to marvel at this for a second here, because we have a movie that took place in the future in a long line of future episodes of a television series and time travel episodes of a series, and very serious stuff in the past three movies about life and death, and they're mostly exploring the lighter side of things, of enjoying life, of all these different genres that are sort of related if you are able to exercise your passion here in the science fiction world to travel back in time. And so we get like rom-com stuff, we get environmental stuff, we get hospital chases, we get it's kind of silly, and it's very goofy, but it's goofy and silly in a very endearing way, I think.
I wrote hospital antics on my notes here.
Yes, antics is a good word for it. And so they get out of the hospital, they beam to the grass in front of the ship.
Well, don't forget running out of the hospital, like that last shot, they run past the old lady being pushed in her wheelchair, he gave me new kidneys.
Yes, I love it. Well, that's the payoff of the earlier setup. I love that scene. It's so funny. And it's one of those things where it gives you something to be optimistic about with things that change in the future. As shitty as medical care is these days, someday somebody will get a pill that'll give them a new kidney. You just
gotta put a plastic toy on their forehead to fix their arteries.
Yes, you just gotta have the determination to be the doctor looking for new ways to do things, and not be those doctors who were in the elevator arguing about conventions. And so they beam to the grass outside of the ship, which is a little silly because they open the door, walk inside the ship, except for Dr. Jillian Taylor, who. Is like, well, I want to go with you, and she makes her big plea, and he's like, well, you can't, and then he says, beam me in now, and it's like, well, everybody, because of course, everyone beamed there, opened the door, all walked inside except for her and him, closed the door, and then they're going to beam him inside. And the staging of this one scene is just sort of mind-bending, and like, why did that happen? And so they beam him in, and she jumps on him and says, surprise. But it's pretty silly. So it's pretty silly, really, because they beam both of them in to the ship. And then it's just like, oh, well, she's here now. And it's like, what do you mean? Oh, well, she's here now. He's like, you just beam her back outside.
Like, if yeah, it was it's really, like, you tricked me.
Yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, how were you deceived exactly? Like, you do realize that she can leave again. Like, you didn't go back to the future already. That's not how this transporter worked. You already used it on her once. She's seen the ship. but they just kind of go with it from here on out. Supposedly in the original script, Nicholas Meyer had wanted to leave her in the past. And so that she, because he wanted it so that humans of the time use their own agency in order to change things to be better in the future. And he wanted to sort of like say that, she stayed behind in order to change things to make things better for the future. But instead
they didn't take the whales?
No, but they took the whales. It just didn't take her. But they ended up taking her in the film too, for, I don't know, reasons. Because she doesn't really do much for the rest of the film. They take off, and then they go fly through the atmosphere and some wibbly-wobbly airplane cloud footage. And then they wind up in the Arctic, in the straits there. And they are going to go get the whales. And conveniently, there is a whaling ship there. Surprise. And they swoop in and at the last minute block the harpoon. In what is, I think, a pretty funny moment of a ship just seeing a giant alien spaceship appear above them on the ocean.
You mean where the captain like tries to turn the ship as hard as he can in every direction, he's not moving at all?
Yes. I quite like it. It's pretty silly and nonsensical, really. But it happened, and it sort of serves its comedy moment.
Yeah, at least they realized like they didn't even have to do anything. Just the sight of them would scare the living crap out of them.
Yeah, it's not like they torpedoed the whaling ship or anything. But they beam up the whales, and then they're like, "All right, well, we got to go to the future now." And part of this movie, through the whole thing, has been Spock like slowly realizing that he can adjust back to being who he was, or at least some approximation of who he was, and not being sort of as robotic as he is at the start of the film. And some of that comes through these moments that we get with him talking with McCoy. We had one of those at the early start of the film. We have one of these here where he's trying to make his calculations and like, oh, well, constants, you know, the mass of the whales in the water through time with the energy, like it's no longer constant. And, you know, there's a whole line about making the best guess and like, well, you know, he's more confident in your guesses than he is in other people's facts. And you get some sense that the character has changed over the course of the film here. They go to the future to the exact moment where they left, where the ridiculous window brace thing collapsed. And all of those people in the weather center fell over.
Weren't they like literally holding the window with their hands to try and make sure it didn't break?
No, it was that there was that it was like a metal pole with these two plastic octagon plates on either end of it, and they were trying to like push it into place to like brace the window. And it's like, what is that supposed to be doing? But you know, the Star Trek films have a history of these ridiculous devices. In Star Trek VI, there is basically a metal detector being used, and then in Star Trek II, there is a space vacuum. It's just pretty silly stuff, and that is certainly one of those moments where it's silly.
In Star Trek, do they use the three seashells?
No, they don't. They don't do that at all. but the you know, the ship's crashing. They got to get the whales out. Everybody blows the hatch, which we had seen there at the head of the ship the whole entire movie, so we knew it was there. They go outside, except for Kirk, who has to go back and dive underwater, and we get to see the hairpiece stuff in action. And he releases the door over the release for the door, and lets the whales out. The whale puppets maneuver around for a little bit, and then they start singing, and the probe is like, oh, well, I'm satisfied now, and leaves. sort of a spectacularly undramatic fashion.
It's great that the probe is just like hanging out there looking for whales. And it's almost like it's completely unaware that it's just destroying everything. It's just like, oh, I'm just looking for whales. What are you talking about? Like, it's like looking for ants with a magnifying glass and accidentally setting everything on fire all at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's basically what it's doing. But the funny part, I think, is that it just leaves at the end. That it's just like, all right, well, there's whales here. Okay, I'm going to go back now.
Yeah, you forgot your line and your hashtag. There be whales here.
Oh, yeah. There be whales here. There be whales here.
That was a good line. I wrote that one down too.
Yeah, I love it. And they so they're all playing in the water and they're having fun.
And they have a pool party after the whales start singing. Yeah. They're all pushing each other off the ship into the water to swim around.
Yeah, and the silly music. And then they get scooped up and they go on their little debriefing trial thing in front of the Federation Council. And the president's just like, oh, well, in light of the fact that you saved everyone in the world, we're going to, like, waive everything. So you guys are all A-okay now. But for Kirk, they're like, well, there's, you know, we can't overlook, you know, all the stuff that you did. So instead of being Admiral Kirk, now you're going to be Captain Kirk. Like,
they give him a ship back.
Yes. Yeah. Which is just what he wanted, like, for the preceding three movies, what he wanted was control of a ship. And so they give him the thing that is exactly what he wants. And there's a very touching moment here with once everyone, including the weird aliens that have nonsensical makeup, clear out of the room, there's a moment with Mark Leonard playing Spock's father, Ambassador Sarek, Leonard Nimoy, talking to him, and they have a nice little exchange here where you get a sense of acceptance between these characters of how, you know, he chooses what he would like for his future and to be involved with these people, and that they were good friends to him. And it's kind of touching when you know that he had such a difficult time coming to terms with his feelings at the start of the film. And he does say to tell for his father to tell his mother that he feels fine. Which is a message that he will relay when he returns to Vulcan.
Which is hearkening back to that weird computer test he was taking in the beginning of the movie that I didn't quite understand.
Yeah. How do you feel?
I don't understand the question.
Yeah. Well, you're half human, Spock. The computer knows that. Moving on from that weird scene, it just establishes that he's just sort of out of it from being his mind being scrambled into McCoy's mind and then being put back inside of his reconstituted body from a planet that regenerated every cell of his body and then blew up. Unimportant details. It's a good way to end it where he's come full circle on that. And we get to go see the crew being taken to their ship. And they're like, oh, well, I don't know what we're going to be serving on. You know, it could be a piece of junk. And they see the Enterprise, but it's not really the Enterprise because that blew up. This is some other ship that they just said wasn't important enough to have its name, and they repainted it, and it's now the Enterprise. NCC-1701A. And they put the crew on it, and they go out of the space dock, and then they just gun it, and they go to warp, and yay! End credits. Fantastic. Yay! Feel good. Yay!
Hoorah!
Go team. So, Dan. I know this isn't your favorite movie you've ever seen in your entire life, but of the films that I've made you watch, were you able to tolerate this, and do you appreciate some of its construction? If you are incapable of appreciating all of its construction?
I did. I enjoyed it, and I particularly enjoyed the parts that were separate from, like I said in the beginning, that sort of series feel where we're picking up where we left off, and there are confusing bits that make more sense if you'd seen the other movies. But on the whole, this movie is sort of like a self-contained thing. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It was ridiculous to see. And it's always going to be funny when you do, like, drop the future guys into the past thing and watch them try and deal. So it was kind of funny to see that, and you know, whether or not I had seen the show or the movies in general, like, I'm familiar with the conceit of these characters and the conceit of Star Trek. So I felt like I had some sort of understanding of the ground we were building on top of. And I thought this was a fun story to tell, even though it is a completely ridiculous story, this whole search for whales to appease some sort of giant thing that floats in the air and is destroying the world.
Yeah, it's not about the plot. here with this one. It is about purely the entertainment you derive when they go back to the 80s. The other films are stronger on plot things than this one, for sure, by a long shot. But this one is a fan favorite. One of the higher performing at the box office and continuing sales, precisely for that reason of it being a lot of fun. Like, there's, you know, they set out to make, Leonard Nimoy set out to make something that didn't have a big bad guy, and they made it. No crazy big bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and looking at my notes, another thing I loved about this one, I think it's probably more of an 80s thing than a Star Trek thing or a future thing, is like, I think it's in the courtroom scenes in the beginning and in the end there, when there starts to be like a little bit of murmur from the crowd, that the whoever's running the ceremony yells, "Silence!" Like, that's a thing that anyone would ever do. I love when they shout the word "silence." Like, that's an appropriate way to act in any sort of situation.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a thing. But I'm glad we could celebrate something that Leonard Nimoy made, and he didn't go on to make a lot of films. He did far more acting than he did anything else, and most of his acting was as Spock. But he directed Star Trek III and this Star Trek, and some episodes of T.J. Hooker, he directed Three Men and a Baby, which was the number one box office success of the, what was it, 1987 or 1988, I think. So he was pretty good at all of this stuff. Pretty competent execution, I would say.
Yeah, and, I'd agree with that.
Yeah. I greatly respect the influence that he has had on many people in their lives, and I think they should all go check out all of the other amazing things that Leonard Nimoy has done. So the end, the final end, the end frontier. Did you know it was an Academy Award winner?
I did not. I see that it grossed $110 million for a budget of $25.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, it only nominated. It won the Academy of Science Fiction. Never mind. But it was nominated for Best Cinematography by Donald Pienaar-Wren, Best Sound, Best Effects Editing, and Best Music. I don't know how it got nominated for Best Music. as we've clearly established, I'm not a fan of the music in this film.
You think it should have been a little sillier, like the story itself?
No, I think it is too silly, is what I think. If you go and you listen to any of the surrounding Star Trek scores by James Horner or Jerry Goldsmith, you're just like, oh, this sounds like an outer space movie where they go and do things. And then if you listen to this, you're just like, what am I listening to? This is like some crazy 80s jazz fusion nonsense here. And it was. And if you listen to the score for RoboCop 2, also done by Leonard Rosenman, the like main theme is kind of almost the same as the one he used for Star Trek 4. So I'm not a huge Leonard Rosenman fan, but apparently he was BFFs with Leonard Nimoy, so I guess I probably shouldn't talk too much smack about him. But that was how he got this gig.
You wanna put a space button on this episode?
Let's do that weird ruching thing from his space blouse on this and button it up.
As long as it's real poofy down by the wrist. So it was kind of like a pirate shirt.
Yes, it was very much like a pirate shirt. Intentionally so, because it was supposed to be nautically themed, but in a very unsatisfying
way. Is
that
what it was?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, Kirk.
Oh, we didn't even talk about Galaxy Quest and the parallels.
It's still rolling if you want to say anything, or we can just save it for another time.
Okay, so listeners, as you know, I also love Galaxy Quest, and Dan likes it too. Don't you, Dan?
I do, yes. Okay. Don't bully me into liking it.
Okay, well, yeah, I just want you to like you. I just want you to like it of the of your own volition, except unless you don't, and then you do. But so Galaxy Quest is great, and part of it for those who are interested in getting a further sense of Star Trek is that it kind of encapsulates many of the other things about Star Trek. Many people refer to it as one of the better Star Trek movies, even though it is not actually a Star Trek movie, because it deals with many of the things that went on behind scenes of egos being bruised and of people being typecast into certain roles and stuff. And so, of course, Alan Rickman playing Dr. Lazarus, being forced into that role for the rest of his life. Had a hard time coping and dealing with that stuff, and eventually came to understand the importance that it represented to those that admired him and how they were also genuinely good people, and that he got more joy out of that at the end of the film than he was willing to accept at the beginning. He felt like weighed down by this, but it was a relief by the end. And in many ways that parallels Leonard Nimoy's own journey with the playing the character of Spock, where he would have to act as Spock, and that kind of limited what he would go on to do afterwards. He defined many of the characteristics of Spock and of Vulcans and of Vulcan culture, of all of the other Vulcans you would see on the screen, including Zachary Quinto, etc., in the new stuff. So he's a really important person. And he eventually came to grips with playing Spock and being best known for this. But it took many, many, many years of being frustrated that he was sort of locked into it. And he was so frustrated with it that he wanted to be killed at the end of Star Trek II before he started working on it. And then he had so much fun working on Star Trek II that he didn't want to die anymore. And so they gave him an out. That they exploited in the third one, which he directed. And then, you know, by the time we got to the 90s, he countered his 1970s book, I Am Not Spock, with his book that I Am Spock, because he had come full circle on that little voyage of his, where he discovered that it meant something and it had some value to him in a way that he couldn't accept. And I think that is part of the reason why, with his unfortunate passing, that so many people have turned out to say such wonderful things and to want to celebrate his work, because he's had such a great influence on them and he's touched so many lives. And it's not something that a lot of other people could say. So while he was frustratingly typecast into this very specific role, and this is what he's going to be best known for, it is something that not a lot of people are going to be able to say when they too, unfortunately, when you and I kick the bucket. It's not like everybody's going to be like, oh, well, that was Joe's defining role on Defocused, was as Joe. And without Joe being Joe, then the show wouldn't have, I don't know. You know, nobody's going to say that. And so you can have nothing but the deepest respect for Nimoy and the influence he had on other people. So I admire him. End of my gushing.
No, it's a unique position to be in, and difficult for anyone to handle that sort of fame and being typecast with any sort of grace, and then eventually coming to terms with it and using it for good instead of just rolling with it and dealing with it and becoming bitter because of it.
Yeah,
I don't think he did any of those things. I think he was actually able to find the best possible outcome for dealing with his fame and his iconic character.
Well, I mean, he found it eventually, but he was pretty bitter for a while. But he was able to turn that frown upside down, as they say. And he was quite happy with everything. So you know, it's good. And he got along well with Zachary Quinto, and they, you know, did their whole passing of the torch and stuff. So it's one of those things where he seems like a real mensch, as you might say in Yiddish. He's a stand-up guy. a stand-up Vulcan, as it were, and that he defined a lot of really important things in a culture, a specific kind of culture, of sort of an outsidery nerd kind of a thing, and so good for him.
I concur.
Hello, listeners. Dan and I recorded our episode about Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, to celebrate the works of Leonard Nimoy. Unfortunately, after we recorded the episode, but before it went up, Star Trek producer Harve Bennett also died. Harve Bennett is hugely influential to Star Trek in the 80s, and without him, we wouldn't have the legacy that we have for Star Trek. It is important to remember his contributions to all of the films, in particular to Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home, where he shares a story credit with Leonard Nimoy, did part of the writing with Nicholas Meyer, and produced the entire thing. So thank you very much to Harve Bennett and Leonard Nimoy.